Good morning, everybody. This morning's share will, my learning will be dedicated to Amos, in memory of Amos Ben Chemisa and Israel Ben Yaakov Saleh. Okay, this week's parasha is Parashat Truma. In it, Hashem gives us the mitzvah, the command, Va'asu li mikdash, v'shachanti b'sochon. This is God's command to the Jewish people to build, to become builders, and to build what will be the most seminal piece of architecture for the Jewish people, the Mishkan. The Mishkan occupies, as a topic, the single most text dedicated to any topic in the entire Torah. 4.5 parashios that comprise the end of Sefer Shavuos. The Mishkan is the precursor of the Beis HaMikdash, which is the ultimate, more built-up form of the Mishkan. And the Beis HaMikdash itself, when it is described in both Sefer Melachim Aleph and in the Rehanim and Beis, only occupies about 125 psukim of text. So the Mishkan, therefore, is the most logical place to start to do an exploration of what I call the architectural history of the Bible. Now, of course, when I say architecture and the Torah, or architecture and the Jewish people, the first and perhaps the only two edifices that we think of are the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. We don't really think that there's much else to talk about. But in today's share, I'm going to share with you several other structures, several other building typologies, which are not only very important, not only exist, but they're actually very important symbolically in their meaning for the building of the theology of Yiddishkeit. And in fact, we should point out that architectural monuments, artifacts, and great works of art are not necessarily the legacy of Yiddishkeit, of Judaism. This is not what we as a people historically are known for, mostly because right now, our Beis HaMikdash, which would be the pinnacle of our architectural expression, lies in ruins. And yet we still exist. We are not ruined, despite the fact that our building is ruined. And therefore, we have to contextualize the meaning of architecture, and we have to understand that architecture is always symbolic of something else. It contains meaning and symbolism which transcends mere design, mere bricks and mortar. Last year I heard a lecture by the world-famous Jewish architect Daniel Liebskind. You may know who Daniel Liebskind is because originally he won the commission to design the Freedom Tower at Ground Zero. The tower that now stands there is not of his design, but nevertheless, whatever the New York City politics were that sort of pushed him out of the process, the bottom line is that he did win the commission, and that became a world platform for his ideas. You may also know him as the designer of the Holocaust Museum in Berlin, Germany. Daniel Liebskind said in his lecture last year at the Jewish Center that the Torah understands architecture better than many contemporary architects understand architecture. Because the Torah understands fundamentally that architecture is meant to embody ideas and symbolism. And of course, if you know the style of Daniel Liebskind's architecture, you will know it is very symbolic, it is very laden with meaning. The museum, the Holocaust Museum in Berlin, is actually shaped like a lightning form, and it's, you know, it expresses the idea that there was a crack of light in the darkness and we still survive. It's a fascinating, exuberant style of architecture, and it's not the simple rectangles that we occupy on a daily basis. But he is correct, and I have the proof text for Daniel Liebskind's claim, V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti v'socham, as Parshas Truma Perek Chapei, Pasuk Ches says. This pasuk, right off the bat, implies that architecture needs to be symbolic. Why? Let's step back and take a big picture. Because it's ludicrous. God does not need a house to live in, a physical place to live in. Hashem revealed himself to us on Har Sinai and gave us the Torah, and that's how he lives with us. So why does Hashem need a house? So right off the bat, the pasuk itself is indicating that, no, the house that we build for God is symbolic of something larger. There's a bigger message here. Additionally, the seeming grammatical error that is contained in the pasuk is another tip-off. Va'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'sochem, and not b'socho, and I will live amongst them, and not in it. Meaning, God is declaring that the purpose and the meaning and the symbolism of this house, of this mikdash, of this mishkan, is really symbolic rather than physical. He won't need a physical place to live. He will want a place to live with us. And indeed, the Mefarshim, particularly Ramban and the school of Ramban, embrace this as meaning and the reason for our building a Mishkan. In source number 4, I give you just a small quote from Ramban Hakdama to Parshas Truma, in which he says that the purpose of the Mishkan was to be a continuation of the Sinai experience. Hashem revealed himself, we heard his voice ourselves, but now what do we do with that? We receive the Torah, we receive the Luchos as the physical proof or documentation of the Har Sinai revelation experience, but how do we carry with us this revelation and this segula and this holiness? So Ramban says, we'll read it together, V'nehim kedoshim ru'uyim sheyehiyeh bahem mikdash v'hashrot shrinaso b'nehem. We earned it. We stood at Har Sinai, we said nasa v'nishma, so now we earned the building of this mikdash. V'lachin tiva tachila al davar ha-mishkan sheyeh lo b'ayis v'sochom mikudash v'shmo. It will be a place wholly dedicated to God's holiness. What is the purpose of the Mishkan? The purpose is to literally, physically carry with us the revelation experience. And the Ramban goes on to say that this is proof. This is the reason why the very first command after the Asuli Mikdash V'Shachanti V'Socham is the command to build the Aron. Usually, when we build a house, we start with the outside. You don't start designing the furniture before you own the home. First you build the outside, and then you move inwards. Here the instructions seem to go inside out. First we're starting with the command to build the Aron, but he said, no, the purpose of Hashem prioritizing the instructions to build the Aron is that the Aron carried the tablets, and the tablets were the proof of the revelation, and the revelation is what now we must carry with us. It will be a way to wrap spirituality and carry spirituality with us throughout the next 40 years in the desert. This is contrasted to the school of Rashi. Rashi and the school of Rashi, Sephardim in the extreme, says, actually, no, the Mishkan was not lechatzila. We were not supposed to have a Mishkan. We were supposed to just worship Hashem one-on-one with mizbachos. Look at Sephardim source number 3, I'm sorry, it's backwards. V'atuli mikdash v'shachanti v'socham lo kemo sheyaeid kodem b'chayim. Not as it was originally designated. Ka'amro, mizbeach adamata asali b'chol ha-makom asher azker shumi avo alecha. We were supposed to just be able to build the random mizbeach and the random expression of our connection to God. And that's the architectural expression, or as architectural as it gets, all throughout Sefer Bereishis from our avos. Avol, atayit tzarech l'kohanim. But now we need kohanim. We need the intermediary. V'zeh b'atzmo v'tzfer b'amro. Aaron, okay, skip ahead to the next sentence. What's the linchpin for Sfarno? The Mishkan and all the physicality and all its materiality and its riot of color and its gold and its wood and its beautiful built-up form was a concession by God to human frailty, of the people as we manifested by sinning with Chet HaEgel. After the Egel, Hashem then realizes, these people can't just have the voice that I revealed to them on Har Sinai, you know, echo in their ears and in their souls and in the emptiness of the vast wilderness in which they occupy. We need to contain this, and we need to make something concrete. We need to actually make a space, make a place. They need gold for a Chet HaEgel, I'll give them gold to cover the Aron, the Kruvim. They need, you know, a riot of color, they need a sensory experience with noise, with smell, with sound, with taste. That's what the Mishkan will be a more proper building of. And of course, this depends upon the Rashi theory of Ein Muktzem U'Me'achar B'Torah, that the events of the Torah are not necessarily presented in chronological order in the text. Because Parshas Truma, with this command to build the Mikdash, the Mishkan, comes 2.5 parshios before Chet HaEgel. So Rashi says that this was done by way of embarrassment. It was too embarrassing to say that right after Har Sinai, where we received the mitzvos and the laven, not to build idols, and then 2 minutes later, the people, well not 2 minutes later, but what was it, 39 and a half days later, the people are already sinning, and they're building an idol, so the text buries it a little bit later so as not to embarrass the people completely. So we have these two schools of thought. But really, they are similar insofar as they state that the purpose of the Mishkan was to carry with us either a tshuva experience. Remember the last time I was here a year ago, maybe it was 2 years ago, I gave you a shiur about what happens to the Luchos Shvuos, what happens to the broken tablets. They were laid inside the Aron with the Luchos Maleos, the second set of Luchos. So we were literally, physically carrying our sin with us, or the symbol of our sin with us, for the next 40 years as a physical, powerful reminder not to sin again. So either we're carrying tshuva with us, or we're carrying the revelation, the holiness of Har Sinai with us, but either way, what we are doing is fiercely protecting ourselves from sinning again. We're fiercely reminding ourselves that we are the Am Segula, and that we are the bearers, the Ol Malchus Shamayim, and literally they will carry the Aron on their shoulders with all the other Klei HaKodesh, with all the other parts and accoutrements that make up the Mishkan. We carry it in our spiritual center, and it resides in our spiritual center as a powerful, fit, psychological reminder of who we are and what our particular mission is in this world. Now, let's talk about the architectural construction of the Mishkan, and let's look at this little picture that I found on the internet, Mapet HaMishkan. We know that the Mishkan was designed and built as a nested and layered construction. So if the Luchos are the most important elements, they reside at the very center, surrounded by and carried by the Aron outside of it, which resides in the Kodesh, which is fronted by a Parochas, which is fronted by the Kodesh, and all these layers and curtains overlaying them. The Mishkan itself is inside a Chatzer. And then there's some debate, like maybe the Ohel Moed is a term that refers to the entire complex, and the Mishkan was just the center complex. Most people say, no, they're interchangeable terms. But Lamaisa, this is a nested and layered construction with graduated spaces of entry, who's allowed where. With, of course, at this point in time, only Moshe Rabbeinu being allowed on the very inside to the Kodesh Kedushin to hear the voice of God through the Kruvim. Now, look at the picture that I gave you. This also shows how B'nai Yisrael itself were encamped. And if you turn the page to the next source, number 5, there's a typo. That's actually Parshas Bamidbar Parfeis, number 6. Cross out the first two words, the first word and the third word. It's really Parshas Bamidbar Parfeis, Pasuk Aleph and Beis. Look at Beis. Ish al diglo ba'osos l'deisa v'asam yachanu b'nei yisol mineged saviv v'oham lo'i yachanu. So not only was the Mishkan a nested and layered construction, But the way the people encamped in a rigid formation, the word degel has militaristic meaning, that this was a formation, like a military march, and everyone had their space and everyone had their designated place, and each of the tribes surrounded the Mishkan. And then, if you look at Masechta Sukkah in source number 7, you see that the Chi Basukos Hoshati at Bnei Yisrael, that's, I believe, from Sefer Vayikra, that pasuk. And what does the Gemara interpret this to mean? Ananei kavod hayu, divrei Rabbi Eliezer. That they weren't sukkos mamish, but rather there were ananei kavod surrounding the people. So what we have is layer upon layer upon layer of buffering of what makes us special, of the Torah that was given to us at the very dead center of the people. And this is how we marched through the desert for 40 years in this extremely enclosed form. This is an architectural construct and actually a city plan. Remember, the census was 600,000 men between the ages of what, 20 and 60, so they had to be at least a million people at least. So this is essentially a traveling city throughout the desert. So the first city, the first Jewish neighborhood is designed to be 100% insular, 100% turning inwards. The Mishkan itself is designed to express fierce protection of our particular designation as Am Segula. Now, let's contrast this type of design to other pieces of architecture in the Torah in order for us to glean some lessons for ourselves, okay? Because here we are, and we're looking at the first Jewish community, and this is how it's designed. Is that a tip-off to us today? Is that how we should live? Is that how we should design our homes? Is that how we should design our cities and our neighborhoods and our communities? Not so fast. The next piece of architecture which I would like to analyze is the Ohel. Now the Ohel first makes its appearance in Sefer Bereishis, and it is associated most famously with our first Av, Avraham Avinu. And we're going to analyze the episode in Avraham Avinu's life where he is sitting in front of the Ohel in Parashat Vayera, Perek Yechet, Pasuk Av. Vayera Elav Hashem De'elo Le'mamre V'hu Yoshev Pesach Ha'ohel Tachom Hayom. Let's give the background. Avraham Avinu has just had his first milah. The Mefarshim tell us it's day 3, the height of his pain, his physical pain. The text goes out of its way to say Kachom Hayom. It's extremely hot outside. This is the setting. Where is Avraham? Is he lying in bed and recovering? No. Avraham the intrepid, Machnas Oreach and Baal Chesed, is sitting Pesach Ohel Kachom Hayom, and he's complaining, the Mefarshim tell us, Hashem, how come you're not sending me any guests? You know that I just live for guests. Why don't I have any guests today? Pasuk Beis, Vayisa Einav, Vayar, V'hinei Shloshah Anashim Yitzavim Olav, Vayar, Vayarach, V'prasa, Mipesach Ha'ol, Vayishtachu Arza. And then he sees these three passers-by, whom he thinks are travelers in need of Hachnasas Archam. He is overjoyed. He gets up. He runs after them. He is so happy. He has his guests. And he's able to fulfill his mitzvah. Now, we all know there are several Midrashim, particularly that I've written down in source number 9 in the Yalkut Me'amloiz and source number 12 on the next page, Pirush Rabbi Yonah Al-Avos, that tell us that the architectural design of Avraham Avinu's tent was that it was open on all four sides. Now, this is a striking contrast to the closedness that we just witnessed in the Mishkan, in the desert encampment of the people. Okay? So we have an absolute contradiction. The first Jewish home in Jewish history, the home of Abraham and Sarah, is open on all four sides. They stand guard at the Pesach in order to seek out, to search out for passers-by, for guests, for the other, for the outsider. They're looking to bring the outsider to the inside. But Bnei Yisrael, the first Jewish community, resides in a very different type of construction, in a very different type of design and plan. Now, let's elaborate a little bit on Hachmasas Arachim of Avraham Avinu. And by the way, I found in source number 11 a fascinating source. It's the Avos Rabbi Nasan. Sometimes it's called the Medrash, sometimes it's called the Gadita. It's not clear exactly what it was, when it was. It seems to be like 8th century. And basically it's a collection of comments by Rabbi Nasan on Pirkei Avos. Now I apologize that I didn't designate where we're going to read from, but let me give you the background of what this very large source is saying. What Rabbi Nasan tells us is that actually there was someone else in history who had a tent that was open on all four sides, and that was Iyub. And that's actually a fascinating little point to add to the life story of Iyub, but this is not a shiur on Iyub. Let's talk about how Rabbi Nasan compares the tent of Iyub to the tent of Avraham. Iyub, when he is stricken with all of his tzaras, goes before Hashem, and he says, Hashem, was I not the greatest of the Machnas Archim in the world? I built a tent, I erected my home, so that it was open on all four sides, so that guests from all over the world could come from every direction, north, south, east, west. Does not that make me exemplary? Is that not a source for something? And Hashem says to Iyub as follows. So, I'm going to ask you to count 8 lines up from the bottom. The sentence on the right starts with Lama Aleph, it's a little shmuchik. So skip to the middle of that sentence, the Atal Tichin Amar Le HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Hashem is going to respond to Iyub's claim that he was a great Machnas Olam. Atal Tichin Amar Le HaKadosh Baruch Hu Iyub, Iyub. Adayim Lo Higatav Al Chakti Shior Shel Avraham. We haven't even accomplished half of the mitzvah of Avraham. Atay Yashiv Yishu Had B'Tok Be'Yisvah Ba'Arfinich Nasim Atzvachah. You were just sitting and waiting for the guests to come. It was a passive type of Hachmasas Arachim. They came to you. Eshadar Cholachol Patzlitim Ha'achalta Patzlitim. Eshadar Cholachol Basar Ha'achalta Basar. Eshadar Cholishnos Yayin Hishkifo Yayin. And you fed everybody according to their level, according to what they were used to. About Avraham, Lo'ach Lachim. But Avraham was not like this. Elo Yotzei Mehader Ba'olam. Avraham was active. You were passive. Avraham was out there. He was spreading the light of Hashem. He was spreading monotheism. And he was actively searching for the others, the guests, to come into his home. And furthermore, Eshe'in Darchol Lachol Patzlitin Ha'achilehu Patzlitin. Eshe'in Darchol Lachol Basar Ha'achilehu Basar. Ve'eshe'in Darchol Lishtotzein Hashgehu Yayin. He fed people a level above. If they were used to drinking water, he fed them wine. If they were used to eating vegetables, he fed them meat. So Avraham's mitzvah far surpassed your mitzvah of Hachmasas Arachim. And now, Avos Rabbi Nasan gives us a beautiful little architectural gem that enhances the legacy of the architectural legacy of Avraham Avinu. And he says, 3 lines from the bottom, below Od, Ela Amad Ubanah Paltirin Gedolim Av Hadracham V'hiniyach Sham Achal U'mishkeh V'chol Haba Nechnas Achal V'shasah. What else did Avraham do? It wasn't just his tent that was open on all four sides, but he erected these palaces of Hachmasas Arachim along the way. And then he brings a proof text at the end. He says, second to last line from the bottom all the way to the left, Vayita Eshel Be'er Sheva. That mysterious and strange word, Eshel, right? What does it mean? Rashi tells us it's an anachronym, Achila Shasiya Anina. That's what an Eshel is. So apparently, Avraham Avinu left his little Eshels all along the way. Wherever he traveled, he built Hachmasas Arachim palaces, hotels, call them what you will. Now just in case you think this was an exclusive trait to Avraham, it wasn't. Sarah Imenu also shared this beautiful mita of Hachmasas Arachim. And we know this because the Yalkut Me'amoles in source number 14 says, when Yitzchak marries Rivka and brings her home to his mother's tent, we have the pasuk in Parashas Chayisara in source number 13, Parakhtal Samach Zayin. It says, "Vayivyeha Yitzchak ha'ohela Sarah imo." Incidentally, to my disappointment, the Torah never uses any expression Ohel Abraham. That would be cool, but it doesn't. It says Ohel Asara twice, but it never says Ohel Abraham. So the Ohel is actually an architectural symbol very much associated with Sarah. And the Mayamoleh, in source number 14, it recounts all those miracles that were in Sarah Imenu's tent. The candles lit from week to week. The challah was fresh from week to week. The Hama'ala HaRevi'it, the fourth advantage or miracle of her, or aspect of her tent, Tamir Hayu HaPsachim Tzuchim L'Racha. Her doors were always open to poor people as well. So both Abraham and Sarah were in this together. And we know that it's an important thing in a marriage for a husband and a wife to be on the same page with regard to their policy of Hachnasas Arachim. This was a couple that got it right. They were on the same page. Now, in truth, this was their mission. This is what they were told to do, really. In Bereshit Parashat Lech Lecha, Perek Yudeis, Pasuk Aleph, Hashem gives Abraham and Sarah their mission statement. What is it? Ve'yomer Hashem al Abraham, Lech Lecha Me'aretz Achar. This was meant to be a kirov professional couple par excellence. They are taking the show on the road. They are mahader ba'olam. They are spreading the light of monotheism all over the world. And in the midst, so clearly, the architectural motif for them, they couldn't be a palace. Their architectural motif needed to be a tent. They were a traveling show, right? They were traveling. And this is similar to the Ohel Moed of Bnei Yisrael. They were traveling. This show had to be mobile. And their architectural presence needed to be mobile. But the fact that they then, you know, take it up a notch and design it with their particular imprimatur to be open on all four sides really expresses something very different about Abraham than Bnei Yisrael later on. And it behooves us to remember that Abraham, Rashi tells us, is an acronym for Av Hamon Goyim. Abraham was a man who was a father to all people. And remember, Abraham was a world-renowned figure. He fights the four kings, the five kings. He knows Paro. He knows Abimelech. This guy, he knows people. People know him. He is clearly an eminently open-minded person. So it makes sense that his architectural motif, the Ohel, will bespeak universality, universalism, open to all streams of humanity, and no fear of the other, of an outsider. So, what we are left with, it seems like, a complete contradiction. What is the home that we build for ourselves supposed to look like? Are we to emulate Ohel Abraham? Are we to emulate Ohel Moed? Bnei Yisrael or Abraham Avinu? In order to amplify the question, maybe clarify the question, we're going to actually look at a third type of architecture in the Torah, and that is the Teva. The Teva, as you know, is associated most prominently with Noah. And just like the Ohel expresses the character and the personality of Abraham Avinu, the Teva is going to also symbolize and be expressive of the character and personality of Noah. First, let's talk about the Mivne, the actual structure of the Teva. In Parashat Noach, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer Elokim LaNoach, Kate Kol Basar LaFanai, Ki Malach HaAretz Chamas Mekneyan V'Nini Mashvisa Mesa Aretz. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, Hashem declares to Noach that the end of all humanity has come before God, and God has now decided that he will destroy humanity because they are guilty of Chamas. Total corruption. And Pasuk Yedalad, Hashem now gives Noah his marching orders. Aseh lecha tivas, aseh gofar kinyan. Ta'aseh et hativa v'chaparta asal mibayis u'mechutz v'chofer. Hashem is going to now teach Noah how to build a ship. And arguably, this is the first piece of architecture in the history of the world, and in certainly biblical history, but in the history of the world. Okay? We have a ship. We have a ship builder. Noah is a ship. And when you think about this ship and the specifications here, v'chaparta asal mibayis u'mechutz, okay, v'chofer, Noach is being taught to waterproof the inside and the outside. So in my imagination, this ship is nothing like all the illustrations that you get, that we've grown up with, for the children and in the children's book. It's nothing like that Noah's Ark that we play with as children, and therefore I did not include a picture of it because I think that is a false representation of what this ship possibly could have looked like. I think this ship was a submarine. I think the ship was completely waterproof on the outside and on the inside so that it could submerge in the depths of the water. And when you think about it, it was like a capsule, completely enclosed. What's the next pasuk? Or actually, skip the pasuk tesayin. Sohar ta'aseh lateva. Sohar, what is it, sohar? There's a fancy Latin word that I don't know, maybe some of you know, of a word that appears only once in the Torah and never again. I don't know, the Bible scholars know that, not me. Anyway, there's a Latin word that describes a word that appears in the Torah only once and never again, and Sohar is one of those words. So we translate Sohar as a window. So in my submarine that I've just conjured for you, it's essentially a porthole. But why is it this weird word? Like, why isn't it Chalom? Like, what's going on here? And the answer is that, well, the Midrashim illuminate this, and they say that really, probably, that Sohar was not a window. It was not translucent so that you could see out of it. It was not transparent so that you could see out of it. It was translucent. It admitted light, but did not in, but did not admit views out. So it was probably some sort of stone that was able to do that, or like a piece of stained glass, but it needed to be thicker and stronger to take the water and the heat of the destruction of the world around the world. Now, why is this structure so important and how does it reflect the character of Noah? Let's look at verse number 17 to understand the kavanah, the meaning and the symbolism of the Torah. Eila told us, though our parakha pasuk tes tells us, which is text that precedes what we just read, Eila told us, Noah ish tzadik tamim hayah bedorosa. So Rashi and the Mefarshim ask, what is this extra expression, Hayab Dorosav? Noah was a tzaddik, so he was a tzaddik. Why do we have to say Hayab Dorosav? And Rashi tells us it's actually a qualifier on his greatness. He was not actually a great man. If he would have lived in the generation of Avraham Avinu, he would not have stood up to the greatness of Avraham Avinu. In comparison to Dorosav, to his generation, he was the best there was, so God taps him to be the one to be saved, to be the one from whom all of humanity will issue forth afterwards. Now, why is this important? Because here we have another family at the beginning of time that builds for itself a house, a household, okay? And is this our role model? Should we look like this? And the answer is absolutely not. And last year I was here and I gave you a shiur called Those Who Stood Up to God, the Advocate. Okay, and I spoke about the people who didn't advocate. So the obvious advocates and the people who stood up to God are Avraham Avinu, who davened for Sodom, or Moshe Rabbeinu, who saved Bnei Yisrael after Chayta Egel, and there are a couple other advocates. But then there are those who distinctly did not advocate for others, and who seem to be deaf, and seem to be immune to the pending destruction of others, Noah being one of them. And last year we learned together a Zohar on Parshas Vayera that talks about Abraham when Abraham approaches God. And it compares Abraham, Noah, and Moshe, these three people who were given the opportunity to advocate to prevent God from wreaking havoc on the world and to prevent God from the destruction he was about to bring upon the world. And clearly, it's very critical of Noah. Noah, he didn't care. He had his boat. The boat had enough room for his family, for his food source, for his pets, and he was good to go. And furthermore, not only was he saved, but he was soundproof. He was waterproof. He was visionproof. He didn't want to hear the suffering or see the suffering of others. You know, some people are malamed close on him that Zohar was the cleanest thing, that he shouldn't look upon other people's destruction as a spectacle. But in my rendering here, I think it's a negative. It's that he was so not attuned to the suffering of others. He so did not care. He squandered all those years of building this submarine for himself from giving muster to his countrymen, to his fellow human citizens, and telling them, you better save yourselves. And you might argue that he was just following instructions. He was just following orders. Here are his orders. I just showed them to you. Hashem doesn't command Noah to stand up to him and argue. He doesn't invite Noah to do this. But guess what? Hashem doesn't invite Avraham Avinu or Moshe Rabbeinu to argue with him either, and yet they do. And the argument that Avraham has, incidentally, comes right after the psukim that I just quoted you in Parshas Vayera. And it's probably one of the most enigmatic and astonishing arguments to occur in the entirety of the Torah. It's bizarre. Avraham is begging Hashem, ha'ach, tisbeh, tzadik, and rasha. How could you tell me that every single person in Sodom is bad? Like, how many millions of them? You can't stereotype and say that every single one of them is guilty and evil. There must be 50 people that are good, in whose merit you can save them. Okay, maybe there's 40, 30, 20, 10. He argues with God. So last year I gave you this shiur called The Advocates, Those Who Stood Up to God. And right after the shiur, I went across the street to the Wise Garden sale, and the first book that I see on the first table is a book with the title Abraham, the World's First Lawyer. And it's written by Alan Dershowitz. And I was like, I gotta buy this book. Okay, so that's the point. The point is that sometimes the task of the lawyer is to defend the indefensible. Sodom? I mean, it doesn't get any worse. They were clearly guilty. And in the end, Abraham loses his arguments, and they are destroyed. In the end, Moshe Rabbeinu wins his argument, and Bnei Yisrael are not destroyed. But the point is, even if it's a losing battle, and even if it's for a guilty party, Avraham Avinu, the Av Hamon Goyim, understood intrinsically, fundamentally, that his job was to stand up and to say, "Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat," God, this is unjust. You can't just destroy humanity. So Noah's teva, as an enclosed to the extreme, a hermetically sealed house form, is clearly not a role model for us. This is not the way we should build our homes. But we are still left with the dilemma, so what does our home look like? Is it buffered and layered and fiercely protected like the Mishkan and the desert encampment, or is it open like the home of Abraham Avinu? We're going to answer this by looking at the next piece of architecture, and that is the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash, now first of all, I just want to give you a word about these two images. First of all, a shiur about architecture had to have some imagery, because architecture is a visual art. Now, I will say, though, that what the Torah leaves us with is just words and no pictures. It should be noted that I am an architect, and I'm just going to make small tangents here. In modern architectural practice, by contract and by law, my deliverables to any of my clients are twofold. Number one, I need to deliver a drawing set with plans and sections and elevations and details. And number two, I have to deliver something called a spec book, a book of specifications. And that is a very detailed written, it's just a normal book, it's actually very thick, the bigger the project. And in it, it contains descriptions of materials, measurements, how to build, what manufacturers are acceptable, and it's so boring. And we architects, we always push it to the end, and we, you know, we're always pushing our deadlines. For the drawings, so how much more so, for the spec book, we forget about it, etc. So it occurred to me, while I was preparing this year, that, you know, I shouldn't be so disrespectful to the specs, because the Torah is the specifications book. That's all we have. We don't have the drawings. We don't have the plans. So on Friday, Erev Shabbos, I quickly wrote an email to the spec department. I work in a large firm, and there are many people who work in my spec department. And I wrote them an email, and I said to them, you know, I'm invited to Yeshiva University on Sunday to give a lecture, and it's going to be about architecture, architectural history in the Torah, in the Hebrew Bible. And I just want to share with you this insight that the Torah only leaves us the spec book, but none of the drawings and none of the diagrams. So the next time a designer gives you a hard time, you just tell them, my profession is both ancient and divine. And the first spec writer in history was God himself. They were very, very happy with my email. Okay, one of them actually asked me to give a lecture at work. I said no. Oh, so now let's look at this picture. Now, I just want to therefore remind you that obviously all of these renderings and all of these images are just an educated surmise that people make based on the text. We don't know exactly what it will look like. There are many versions. If you Google it, you'll get dozens of versions. There are also many Christian scholars who have their own versions, etc. This is the famous picture, photograph of the model of the second temple, not the first temple, that is now in the Israel Museum. I hope you've all been there and seen it. And the source for the building of the Beis HaMikdash is in Divrei Hayamim and is in Malachim Aleph, and it's too long to quote, but right off the bat, even in this artist's own rendering of the Beis HaMikdash, we know that the structure, the way it was built, was very similar to the Mishkan. And in fact, this is interesting. It's not, it was a new idea to me in preparing this year, but it bears out right in the Pasuk. I didn't bring the actual Pasuk with me, but the bottom line is that there is a theory with a proof text in Malachim Aleph that the Mishkan that resided in Shiloh, the Mishkan Shiloh, was actually put inside the Heichal. So if that's true, then talk about layering and nesting. It's like yet another further layer and nesting that occurs, that the original Mishkan is inside this newly built marble and stone Heichal, which is surrounded by this beautiful complex and the Azara, and then ultimately set up off on a plinth. And obviously there are all these, you know, go and no-go zones with, you know, layering of who's allowed and who's not allowed where. So once again, the Beis HaMikdash is a structure that seemingly communicates interiority, not exteriority. Those are architectural terms that mean, you know, structures that face inward as opposed to structures that face outward. So we have an echo of the desert encampment and the Mishkan style of architecture as opposed to the concept of Abraham Avinu. And yet, look at source number 21. The Gamel HaNachri, and these are the words of Shlomo HaMelech at the inauguration of the Beis HaMikdash when it is first built. The Gamel HaNachri, and also for the non-Jew, Asher Lo Me'am Chayisal, Hu Va Me'eretz Rechoka L'man Shemecha, Ki Yish Me'unas Shemecha, Okay, skip to Pasuk Mem Gimel, Ata Teshma HaShemayim L'chom Shebtecha Ba'asisa Kachol Asher Yekra Eilecha HaNachri. Okay, what is Shlomo declaring here? In his inauguration, he's davening to Hashem that all of their sacrifices should be accepted, that all of their tefillah should be accepted, the Gamel HaNachri, and he is now designating at the outset, guess what? Unlike the Mishkan, which was so fiercely protected and layered, and we were so afraid of any non-Jewish influence over there, but the Beis HaMikdash, in its ideal built-out form, will also function as a temple for the non-Jews as well. Please, Hashem, accept the prayers of the non-Jews as well. And then, most beautifully and famously, in verse number 20, Yeshayahu and Perek Nun Vav, Pasuk Zion, the second source there, we say, all throughout Sichos Rosh Hashanah and Kippur Davening, we quote this beautiful Pasuk, Bahaviosin el Karpachi, the Simachtin Beis Tefilasti, Olo Sehem Bezivchayim Loratzam al Mizvachim, Ki Beisi Beis Tefila, Yikare Lachol Ha'amim. Yeshayahu echoes this years later by saying, you know what? This Beis HaMikdash functioned as a place for all the world, for all of humanity to come and daven. It really just wasn't for Jews and Jews alone. So there must have been gates, there were 12 gates around the Beis HaMikdash. There must have been a special gate that they were allowed to come through. There must have been a special place that they were allowed to come into. And then, of course, there were special times when they were allowed in to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, before we leave the Beis HaMikdash, I want to point out Bamidbar Rabbah, in verse number 22, points out something else. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua Levi, Ilo haya umos ha'olam yodim ma haya ha'mikdash yafel lahem kastirios ayu makifim oso, kidei l'shomro. Had the non-Jews actually known that they were allowed to access our holy monument and magnificent Beis HaMikdash, Instead of seeking to destroy it, the non-Jews would have actually erected fortifications around it. They were fools to want to destroy it because really it was built for them to. Okay. And then, furthermore, I think this is a really interesting source. In source number 23, Zechariah HaNavi actually ups the ante. Instead of Shlomo HaMelech's invitation, or Yeshayahu's invitation to the non-Jews of the world to come and pray at the Beis HaMikdash, Zechariah, it's a strange set of psukim, but Zechariah actually makes it mandatory. It's a mitzvah to non-Jews that they must attend the Beis HaMikdash when? On Chag HaSukkos. He actually declares Chag HaSukkos as the time, not only when they can, but when they should celebrate in the Beis HaMikdash. So if you just look, and he threatens punishment to the people if they don't. So why don't you look at Pasuk Yerches, or you know, look at Pasuk Yitzayin. V'haya asher lo ya'ala me'is mishpachos ha'aretz al Yerushalayim. Mishpachos ha'aretz is meaning non-Jewish people. L'shachavos ha'melech Hashem tzvakos v'lo aleihem yiyeh ha'geshem. What does he say the purpose of their coming on Chag Sukkos is? Chag HaSukkos is when we say Tevilas Geshem. And what is Geshem? Does Geshem, you know, benefit particularly only Eretz Yisrael or the Jews? No, Geshem benefits the entirety of humanity. All peoples need rain. So that's how Chag HaSukkos is designated for Zechariah as a Chag of the non-Jews coming to the Beis HaMikdash. And then he goes further. He actually declares it a sin if the non-Jewish people do not show up. Now also remember that on Sukkot we give a total of 70 sacrifices, 70 bullocks. And Chazal tell us, what is this number 70? It's like an amazing amount of karbanos, unparalleled than the other Shalosh Rabbim, right? And the answer is that each one of these sacrifices was k'neged the Shivim Ha'umos. So obviously Sukkos is the most universal of the holidays because we're bringing sacrifices on behalf of other nations. What are we doing for them? We're davening for them. We're davening for their well-being. They should be at peace, and then we're at peace, and then the whole world is at peace. So the Beis HaMikdash, therefore, expresses this universality, this element of universality. I would like to end by amplifying the message of the Beis HaMikdash by focusing on another piece of architecture, the last for this morning, but by no means the last piece of architecture in the Torah. I could give you a three-part series, but this is it for today. And we're going to look at the Sukkah, and we're going to talk more about Chag HaSukkos. Okay? And I want to mention that I am grateful completely for my analysis of Chag HaSukkos and the Sukkah to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who wrote a very beautiful, very long, but very beautiful introduction to the Sukkos Machzor, the Koran Sukkos Machzor, that I believe was just published at the beginning of this year. If you don't own it, you should, just for that introduction alone, because it's fascinating, and it was a big treat for me because it was all about architecture. It was a lot about architecture. Okay, so Rabbi Sacks analyzes Chag HaSukkos and the Sukkah in the following way. He said that Chag HaSukkos has two principal mitzvahs associated with it. The first one, the famous one that we think about, is brought down in Parshas Emor, Parak Chaf Gimel, Pasuk Mem Beis, Basukos Teshu Shiva Semim, Kol Ha'ezrach B'Yisrael Yeshu Basukos. Okay, so we have a mitzvah of Sukkah, and it declares in the Pasuk who's obligated to keep this mitzvah, Kol Ha'ezrach B'Yisrael, Jews. This is a Jewish construct. This is a Jewish piece of architecture for Jews. I'm not aware of any halacha that you're not allowed to invite non-Jews, but l'maisa, what is the purpose of the Sukkah? The purpose, in Pasuk Mem Gimel, l'man yedu doroseichem ki basuko soshavti es b'nei Yisrael v'hotzi osa me'eretz Mitzrayim. Okay, what is the purpose? To remember this time, this desert encampment, this time in Jewish history when we so wonderfully, dedicatedly followed Hashem all over the desert, living in mere booths and huts. Okay? Okay. So the Sukkah, therefore, as an architectural construct, it's also, you know, it's not that halachically you're not allowed to have doors, obviously you have to enter it, and it's not that halachically you're not allowed to have windows, but just abstract the sukkah for a minute and distill it to its essential parts. You have its walls, and then it's open to the sky, right? So essentially the sukkah becomes this like meditation hut of you and Hashem. It's very much a spiritual place and a particular place expressing our particular memories and love of Hashem. It's not a place, a universal symbol. Okay. And then we have a second set of mitzvah, a second command that characterizes sukkah. Source number 25, Precious Emor Parachot Gimel Pasuk Mem, Ulakach B'machan B'yom HaRishon Priyitz HaZer Kapos Smarim Ba'anat Yitzavot Ba'arvei Nacham. We have the mitzvah of the Arba Minim. And what is the purpose, what is the kavanah of the Arba Minim? We take these disparate elements of nature, we gather them together, we shake them, and we do our kapos, and what are we davening for? We're davening for rain. So when we sit in the sukkah and we contemplate our relationship with Hashem, that casts God as a God of Jewish history. But when we take our Arba Minim and shake them, what are we conjuring? We're conjuring this relationship with God, who is the universal God, who is the God to all of humanity, because all of humanity needs rain. We're davening for the world. We're not just davening for our own personal needs. So we have these two seemingly contradictory mitzvahs, and not only that, but by the way, he points out this interesting point, that what happens if we're davening for rain and we're successful in bringing rain, what happens to our sukkah? It nullifies the next of sukkah. We don't have to sit in the sukkah. So it seems like one is actually preempting the other. Are they contradictory? And the answer is, it's not just Shlomo HaMelech, who's also, like Avraham Avinu, a world political figure, you know, who's obviously a very big universalist in his approach to world peace. Okay? It's not just that he built his temple to gather in and make a place for and allow the non-Jews, but Hashem himself, in the divine commands that we receive ourselves, Hashem himself is proving to us. At the pinnacle of your fierce celebration of Am Segula, our own Jewish history of being in the desert encampment, celebrating the full spread of our 613 mitzvot. You realize that nearly half of the 613 mitzvot are related to the Beis HaMikdash. So without the Beis HaMikdash, we can only celebrate half of our religion. So when the Beis HaMikdash stands, that is the moment in Jewish history, very short-lived in our Jewish history, where we can actually be fully, fully Jewish and fully, fully express our own Jewish identity. At the very same time that we are at the pinnacle of our Jewish particularity and Jewish specialness, that we live to the fullest the mitzvot of the Am Segula, but we must remember the rest of the world. We're not just Ezrach Yisrael, we're not just citizens of the Jewish people, we are also citizens of the world. And Hashem exhorts us to pray for them, to pray for the entire world. The timing of my shiur is no mistake. We are living in a time where there are plenty of very powerful voices who would make us believe and try to convince us that erecting walls and shutting out the other is what we should do. Well, I disagree, and this shiur is my proof, and I think that the home we build for ourselves and the home we build for ourselves personally and nationally is not a home that excludes the other and loathing and stereotyping. It's a home of justice. We should never dilute the specialness of ourselves, but at the same time, we can fiercely protect what makes us unique and makes us special without excluding the other by building walls that shut them out. Thank you.